A new project is launched in Jacksonville to combine art with activism. Good morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. You can also stream us live right now on Facebook. Just ahead, local arts activist Hope McMath on the launch of Yellow House. What's that all about? Find out and join the conversation right now at 549-2937. Then later, it's Dr. Jennifer Berman of The Doctor's Fame. She'll be on the show. Find out how you can meet her in Jacksonville this weekend. Plus, getting more girls to take STEM classes and pursue STEM careers. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, arts activist Hope McMath is debuting a brand new project. The former director of Jacksonville's Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens is launching Yellow House. It's a new spot in town where art will be used to create community dialogue around important issues. A new way to look at art. What's this all about? Why is the house yellow? What's happening with all this? Hope McMath is here to explain, and she's got a yellow necklace on, too. Hey, Hope McMath, good to see you.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me this morning.
What are your questions for Hope McMath about the power of art to create activism and the launch of Yellow House? Give us a call. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on Facebook, too. So this week, you're combining art and action, two of your passions, with something called Yellow House. And it really is a yellow house, but it's more than that. Tell me all about this. What is Yellow House?
So Yellow House is a space, and yes, it is in a small, intimate building that is yellow, but it's also an idea and a program. It's a place where art is being used to help build community, where art is being used as a bridge between people, and where art serves as a means to convene folks around conversations that are needed within our community.
And this is a physical space over in Riverside Avondale in the Cork Arts District.
Right. So the location is very intentional. It's located really right at the intersection between what some people call North Riverside, the Lackawanna neighborhood, and Mixon Town. And on one side of where Yellow House is the Cork Arts District, which is amazing proximity to a lot of terrific artists in the community. In fact, it's a building where over 50 visual artists, actors, and poets do their work every day. And so that's super exciting. And there's a new art space that just opened there called Space 42. Which is a very large contemporary art space that will also do performances. But on the other side of the building is this edge of a neighborhood that is historically important to Jacksonville. It's dynamic. It's interesting. There are terrific people living and working and playing in that neighborhood. And so I'm hoping Yellow House, as it sits in that intersection, will also create a bridge between those two groups of people.
Here's our question to callers. Do you think art can bring about social change? What are your questions for Hope McMath on the launch of Yellow House? 549-2937. Now, many in town know about you, Hope, that for many years, pretty much your entire career, you worked at the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens, rising all the way to lead the museum as executive director. You push the envelope at the Kummer in terms of staging edgier exhibits, more socially conscious exhibits, exhibits about race in particular. That ruffled some feathers in this community. I know that you can't talk too specifically about everything that happened with all of that, but there was a lot of curiosity about what happened with you leaving the Kummer Museum and what you might do next. How do you see yourself now as someone who is free to, I guess, speak more openly about how you see these issues of race, social and economic justice, and the way you want to use artistic expression, I guess, to spark conversations. For example, right now in Jacksonville, we're having a citywide debate over whether we should contextualize Confederate monuments. Those are pieces of art from another era, and they reflect a really ugly past. That's just one example where I see someone like you adding your voice to the conversation, someone who's prominent, who's known in the community. How are you going to play that role now with Yellow House? And what lessons did you learn, do you think, from your experience at the Kummer Museum?
Well, first of all, let me say my 22-year career at the Kummer Museum was an incredible gift. What a beautiful institution to be associated with, and I certainly learned things that create a list of opportunities in front of me that I would have never had without my time at the museum, whether it was as an educator, an administrator, a director, a co-curator. Those experiences were invaluable, and I was able to engage with some remarkable people. The thing is, with a mission of an organization like the Kummer Museum, it's a dynamic and large institution with lots of needs, and it's a multi-million-dollar budget with a multifaceted mission. And so it cannot be an institution that every day is thinking about the intersection between art and socially relevant ideas. And I realized I had evolved as an individual into someone who felt very strongly about that work. Certainly was not alone in doing that work at the Kummer. There were many deeply involved in it, from sponsors to volunteers to other staff members. But it wasn't clearly at the core and heart of the institution. And so as the Kummer needed to go on and do some other very big and important things, it was clear that it was time for me to also move on and pursue what I thought was critically important, especially at this sort of moment in time in society. And so when I was speaking for the Kummer in that kind of role, you're speaking for a lot of people, and it's hard to lift up one set of beliefs. And so in this particular role, I can do that.
And you can speak for yourself.
Well, I can speak for myself and, more importantly, provide brave and safe space for other people to lift their voices up. And I really feel like even in the work I was trying to do at the Kummer, it was really about amplifying other people's voices and lived experiences versus my own, and just sort of creating the platform for that so that people can engage with one another. And so with Yellow House, certainly there's more flexibility in that. Now, that does mean it will not be for everyone. I do feel very strongly about the conversation about the removal of Confederate monuments. It's something I have felt strongly about for a long time. So as the example you offered up, Yellow House can be very engaged in that work. And in fact, the first exhibition that we will be doing has works by artists in our community who make very strong statements about the removal of those monuments.
So you're going to mount an exhibit of art that will have a message about monument removal?
Well, there are certain pieces in the exhibition that will do that. The first exhibition is actually entitled Small Matters, and it's based on the premise that you can deliver big messages in small packages, whether that be the Yellow House as a small package or artists doing work that are small in scale, but big in power. And so a few of those artists, because they were able to respond to what was happening right now in our community, created works around that topic. But that's just one topic that will be covered in that show.
Yeah. What would you say to those who see art differently than you? They just want to look at a beautiful painting. They don't necessarily want to get a political message of any kind.
That's right. And I actually think, both as an artist and an art historian, I have incredible love and joy in looking at works of art that are simply beautiful. And there will be times that the work that is going to be at Yellow House will also be beautiful. In fact, the first show lifts up works about the environment that doesn't necessarily have a political message, but just reminds us of the beauty and awe of the world around us. I also think there can be messages delivered that have the complexity of both fear and joy. I'm going to do an exhibition this summer around the theme of play and how as adults and children, we don't play enough to really spark our own imaginations. And so does that have a message behind it? Of course it does. Is it political in nature? No, it's something that's highly personal and people will find their own story within it.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Hope McMath about the debut of Yellow House in Jacksonville, turning art into action. What are your questions? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Neil is in downtown Jacksonville. Hey, Neil, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I was wondering if we'd see different types of art. I know you guys, I know Ms. McMath has a background in visual art at the Comer, but I was wondering if we see things like spoken word, dance, music, et cetera, at the Yellow House.
Sure.
Great question. I have a passion for multi-arts experiences, and the Comer was a great example of that, as are many of our arts institutions in town. Yellow House is an intimate space, has some limitations on that, but we are not going to let that limit the opportunities of other artists. We will have spoken word artists participating at Yellow House, musicians. In fact, there's a great guy who's one of my neighbors now who's a barbecue master, and we're going to start a barbecue and blues night once a month, barbecue blues and art. In fact, for the opening weekend of Open House, Dante Palmer is going to be doing some spoken word small works at the Yellow House. So yes, we really see it as a space where the arts combine, but where conversations also happen.
And so people know where this is. It is at Phyllis and King Streets, and you painted it bright yellow.
It is bright yellow. You cannot
you can't miss it. Okay. And why yellow?
So yellow, it's an interesting story, and I'll keep it brief. But when I first moved into the neighborhood and was meeting the neighbors immediately around the house, and people would ask me where I had moved into with this business, I said, the house on the corner of Phyllis and King, and they kept referring to it as the Yellow House. Well, it really wasn't yellow at that moment. But when they were calling it Yellow House, it triggered for me my own Yellow House, which is the home that my grandparents lived in Ohio. And that home was really the center kind of my family's orbit. And it was a place where I really became, for the first time, politically conscious. My grandfather believed in civic engagement as somebody who came back from World War II. My uncle is a radical, and I don't mind saying
that.
Are
you a radical?
I don't think I'm a radical, not as far as he would be for certain. And so Yellow House, for me, is highly symbolic. And then, of course, for those listeners who know art history, Yellow House was something important in the life of Vincent van Gogh. It was really the first space that he moved into in the south of France, where he committed his life to being an artist.
549-2937 to join us. Now, you mentioned your relatives are from Ohio. You, though, did grow up in Jacksonville, correct?
I am. I am a native.
And so as a native, I'm not from here. I'm from Ohio. but as a native, I think people that have grown up here have really strongly held opinions about the issue I touched on a moment ago. There are pieces of art in public places that, not just in Jacksonville, but around the country, not just the South, that are now, we see activists demanding that they be removed. Many cities are removing these monuments to the Confederacy. Their art, however, they are extremely offensive and painful to many Americans. As someone who grew up here and as someone who really understands the power of art to express narratives, you say you have a strong opinion about these monuments. What do you think should be done with them?
Well, I certainly believe they need to be taken out of public spaces. I do not believe that any of our citizens should walk into or through a public space and have to stare at the image of their oppressor. And yes, they are art in that they were made by artists. They are skillfully done. I'm not somebody who necessarily believes they need to be destroyed, but I do think they need to be moved. I think there are plenty of places that uphold the histories that people claim are being told by these particular monuments. I would rather go to the Smithsonian Museum of African American History or the Whitney Plantation in Louisiana, one of the few places that actually tells the truth about the life of slaves within the context of the plantation system. I am not sure that holding up those symbols of Confederate soldiers does much to actually bring our community together. And so I do believe they need to be removed. I personally am not a fan of just putting them in a, keeping them where they are and providing a different context. I think that's putting a Band-Aid on a huge gaping wound. And I think a lot of people are stating that that history needs to be told, that if we don't have those monuments there, we won't necessarily have that history in front of us, that we would be somehow editing that history out of our past. And, you know, my response is, I wish we could change that history. It's a dark and awful history, and I'm not sure those monuments have done much to actually lift us up out of those racial divides.
Knowing what the locations are for museum display, where should that big, in particular, the big Confederate soldier in Heming Park, where would be an appropriate place to contextualize and display him,
so,
do you think?
I am not sure we actually have the right kind of a place to display it here in Jacksonville. And I know there's been a call to simply move these to one of our museums. As somebody who spent 22 years in a museum, I recognize that museums have their own collecting priorities. They have resource limitations, space limitations, and their own stories to tell. So I'm not sure if we have the right location, and I wouldn't be the one to deem that. But I do know there are locations all over the country where these monuments are going. I actually sit on the Florida Council for Arts and Culture, and we were a part of the removal of the Kirby Smith statue from the Senate building.
In Washington.
In Washington. And we didn't wait to remove that for where we thought it might go next.
Where is it now, by the way?
It is in the process of removal and storage. It's actually been in storage for quite some time anyway, but we have not designated a final home for that. But that doesn't mean it wasn't time to remove it.
And just in you pointing that out, that there's a statue of Kirby Smith, or there was, in the Senate
right.
building in Washington, the Florida Confederate military leader. We have a school named after him.
Right.
You know, that brings up the larger issue that these monuments and symbols and markers are all over the country. They're mm-hmm. not just in southern
That's
cities.
Right. That's right.
And Washington, I guess, technically is a southern city, but not really. These monuments are in Montana. They're in all over the country. And so I know we're getting a little off topic, but it's certainly an issue that we'll continue to cover. But right now, let's take a few more calls for Hope McMath as she launches Yellow House in Jacksonville, 549-2937. Martin is in Riverside. Hey, Martin, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have another idea, and that would be to not to necessarily remove the monuments, but to have more art. In other words, say in Heming Plaza, we invited an international artist who is political or minority, somebody like Ai Weiwei or the architect for the new African American Museum in Washington, to work a second monument, a second sculpture that speaks to the first sculpture and has a different opinion. And I think that sort of conversation of more art rather than less art that actually confronts and has a conversation would be a very interesting way to enliven the plaza, get national attention, and also have a modern voice to the controversy.
Okay, Martin, thanks for that.
It's a brilliant idea, and Ai Weiwei is one of my very favorite practicing artists out there, and I think if we could do something like that well, where they would not necessarily just plop down another sculpture or monument within that space, but actually do something that sort of envelops and changes the current monuments, I think that is an interesting idea to toss around. But I will say, I think as we are having a conversation about this, it's important that we have voices of color at the table. I think it's very easy for many of us as white people, including myself, mm-hmm. to sit here and give our opinion. But what past is represented by those monuments is not my it's not my experience. And so I do think that's something that's missing, and I look forward to that coming to the table.
Michael on the east side. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
Okay.
Good. You know, when you look at the Confederate memorials that exist around the country, we can go back and look at the history that was recorded. You know, John Marshall began the process of writing the reasoning for decisions that he made in Supreme Court justice. But it's also a reasoning for the putting the monuments out throughout the country. The people that did it are no longer here. So what I was thinking is that maybe we could give the statues back to the people that donated them, since they were donated by people. For example, in Jacksonville, Charles Hemming, who was a Confederate veteran, donated the monuments in Hemming Plaza that's named after him. We could just give it back to their descendants and then put them in the backyard or buy a space that's a private space and put them there.
Thanks, Michael.
Michael, you bring up a great point. In best practices of museums, if there are works in a museum's collection that are no longer relevant to their collecting priorities or was brought into the museum at an era where they didn't have particular criteria, first and foremost, they go back to any family members that are still with us to talk about returning the art to those individuals. So it's actually a great idea and something that I think should also be considered.
And it's good to get your thoughts on this because art is powerful. The visual power of visual arts in particular, not just music and poetry. I mean, visual arts really do impact the culture in so many ways.
They do. And think about the history of man and the history of symbols. So many of those come to us through visual culture. They come to us through the art that was made by various cultures. And I think when we look at the conversation today and we talk about the symbolism of flags and of these monuments, they matter. They move people. They help people often feel an idea that otherwise seems very abstract. And it's really that premise that Yellow House is based upon. But you can see that there is power in works of art all across the spectrum.
Do you plan on staging exhibits that will be so provocative as to, you know, they might offend some people? I mean, you've done that in the past. So is that going to be part of Yellow House?
So I will say the goal is not to offend people. The goal is to provide amplification to the voice of artists that I happen to believe are some of our greatest truth tellers. I often think our artists in all art forms are often in front of us in being able to look at the world around us through lenses that can sometimes see a vision of the future and reimagine the past. And so it's not so much set up to create controversy, but the nature of truth telling can often provide a platform for disagreement as well as consensus building. So even in the first show, Small Matters, there are some works there that take a very strong hit against the Trump administration. And there will be some people who will not appreciate those works. My hope is by seeing it as a work of art and entering the conversation through the symbols in it and having conversations with the people in that room, that we can begin to build some bridges.
We're getting lots of tweets and emails about the debut of Yellow House. YMLA Jacksonville tweets the show, "Stoked to hear about this project. We want to bring our students to Yellow House."
Yay.
From will schools get to come?
Yes, we actually have a elementary school right down the street that's talking about doing field trips to Yellow House. So yes.
Transformation Jacks. "Creativity equals taking a fresh look at the familiar. We need to encourage and empower artists to think more often and strategically about their community." Just a few of our tweets. And the website is yellowhouseart.org. The grand opening is coming up at the end of the month.
Yeah, so we're spreading the grand opening up over a weekend so that lots of people can access it regardless of your work and life schedule. So the first night is August 31st, which is Thursday evening from 6 to 8. Friday evening, September 1st from 6 to 8, and then Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. The opening weekend is free. The exhibition will be up. We'll have light food and music, and most importantly, we'll connect with one another.
Hope McMath, best wishes on the exciting new venture. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Hope McMath is the proprietor of the new Yellow House in Jacksonville. Again, that website, yellowhouseart.org. Much more still ahead later. Don't miss it as we speak with Dr. Jennifer Berman of The Doctors. the hit TV show. We've got a preview of her keynote speech this weekend in Jacksonville at WJCT's Girls' Day Out event. But up next, speaking of girls, a new study shows why more of them aren't pursuing careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. A closer look after this.
Next time on 1A, putting sugar on trial. Sugar's not just the root cause of today's diabetes and obesity epidemics. New evidence suggests our addiction to sugar can be connected to heart disease, hypertension, many common cancers, and even Alzheimer's. Can we kick our sweetest habit? That's next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
I call my baby my sugar.
2. Want to learn more about fitness and heart health? Join WJCT and Baptist Health for Girls' Day Out, Saturday, August 26th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Spend the day with experts that will engage you to be a better you. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, session, gift bag, and so much more. Tickets are just $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout and get your tickets today.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
It's easy to listen to WJCT even when you're not near a radio. Just visit WJCTnews.org from your phone or tablet. On our mobile site, you're just one click away from a 24-hour live stream of our programming, and you'll also have easy access to all of the top local news stories. Listen live on WJCT's mobile website, WJCTnews.org.
Welcome back. Well, new research conducted on behalf of Junior Achievement shows a surprising 91% of teenage boys and girls know what kind of job they want after they graduate from high school. But that's where the similarities between boys and girls end. The data shows career preferences still remain drawn basically along gender lines, with some alarming results when it comes to interesting more girls in STEM careers. That's science, technology, engineering, and math. How can we get more girls into those fields, and what does the study show? Sabrina Kinslow is the program manager with Junior Achievement Girls, and she's here now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So most kids in high school know what they want to be when they grow up. The problem is not enough girls want to go into STEM fields. What do the numbers show in this study?
The numbers are showing that the pipeline starts really early. Before, we thought, okay, we need to get students ready in 9th grade. Then it changed to, we need to get students ready in 6th grade. And now it's changing to 3rd and 4th grade, really exposing them. And girls just aren't getting that exposure that boys are when it comes to STEM.
According to what you're learning from this study, 36% of boys want to go into science, tech, engineering, or math. Only 11% of girls. 26% of girls want a career in the arts versus just 10% of boys. And this is interesting. Far more girls than boys want to go into the medical or dental field. That's interesting.
I think it really starts with exposure and what we see as a society with where girls and boys are and the fields we think are best represented by the genders. You know, we're always pushing for those nurturing, supportive type roles for girls, and not saying that, you know, we shouldn't, but it should be more equal along gender lines where girls and boys can do the same thing. There's no big difference in whether, you know, a girl girl can be a nurse versus a doctor, or a boy can be a nurse versus a doctor. Mm-hmm. What are we saying as society? What are we pushing? And again, what access are we giving to our girls at an early age? We see that dip in confidence when it comes to girls with self-image, body confidence, and that plays over into academics and how well they do in school. And we need to do a better job at not only increasing their confidence, self-confidence, but then also how they are in school. And a lot of schools are starting to go to separating genders in classrooms, and that they've seen some significant differences and increase in girls being interested in those academic subjects.
How does junior achievement then, you commissioned this data for a reason. How is junior achievement working to make up those gaps in terms of girls versus boys, academic education?
Two-part. One, we are creating more innovative type educational programs for girls. And then also we're providing access in school to women that are in those fields. So we're bringing in career professionals to the school so they have consistent reminders that there are women in these fields, the type of education that's needed, and also showing schools what the professionals are saying they're needing. So those advanced academic math and science programs should be offered earlier and not just for magnet programs.
And in Duval County, for example, are you seeing too much of that? It's not universally offered. If you send your child to, say, Stanton or Paxson, they'll get that baccalaureate program, but not everywhere.
Very true. We are seeing that. And it's not just in Duval County. It's all across Florida. If it's a magnet program, international baccalaureate, some type of honors program, they'll get that access. But then that's also where organizations like Junior Achievement and other nonprofits come in, where we're able to offer substantial supplemental programming to schools and summer camp programs. So you see a lot of robotics programs, coding, summer camps that focus on STEM. And that's where the supplement comes in, because the schools can't do everything.
You know, it's interesting, too. Students are sort of adjusting their expectations downward, you're finding in this study. More teens expect to work and go to college at the same time, attend a community college, pay for some or all of their education. It's a different world today as teens are contemplating college. Yes. And how they're going to pay for it.
Very true. Economically, just the rise in tuition, even over the past 10 years, has been exponential. Student loans are rising. That's the new credit card scare, right? Student loans for my generation and the generation after me. So that's something that is in the forefront of everyone's mind, paying for college. It's just not accessible to everyone anymore. And you need advanced degrees in almost every field to really be able to progress. No longer does a bachelor's degree cut it. You have to have some type of master's degree or certification after master's to really be able to progress and make a difference in fields that are innovative, such as science, technology, engineering, and math.
How can people get in touch with Junior Achievement to make sure their kids are accessing all this great programming?
We have so many ways for you all to contact us. You can go on our website at www.jajax.com. So that's jajax.com. You can also contact us by telephone at 904-398-9944. For girl-specific programs, contact me directly. You can use that same number in extension 225.
Sabrina Kinslow, she's the program manager with Junior Achievement Girls. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back.
barroco su estilo y ahí en su tiempo con sus preludios y fugas pegó. Y ahora nosotros con nuestra música un homenaje con clave y bongo.
Welcome back. Well, she's a leading expert on women's health. Dr. Jennifer Berman of The Doctors, the long-running hit TV show, is the keynote speaker at WJCT's upcoming Girls' Day Out event this Saturday at the Downtown Hyatt. She gave us this preview. Take a listen. Dr. Jennifer Berman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Lots of excitement as you'll be giving a talk here in Jacksonville for our Good For You event. What's the topic of your discussion?
Well, I'm talking about sexual health and optimizing sexual health and sexual well-being. It's a topic. Sexual health is a critical component of general health and wellness, and it's something that we tend to neglect and not make a priority. And I've sort of built my career around helping women to live their fuller, healthier lives, and optimizing sexual health is part of that.
Right. And you're known for that. And it can be a sensitive subject, but I think one that the women coming to this event are very much interested in. What are some of the biggest issues that your patients grapple with when it comes to this that you'll be touching on?
Well, I think what happens is that we tend to minimize sort of the symptoms and changes and attribute them to other things that are going on in our lives, such as, you know, stress, or, you know, my husband lost his job, or my daughter's, you know, son is having surgery, like all these other things that affect us, and make excuses for things as excuses for things that are changing in our bodies. And granted, it is true. I mean, stress is the number one buster of, you know, libido, not to mention the cause of a lot of health conditions. But it's important that women recognize the subtle changes that that can occur, not only in our sexual arousal and response, but also desire and interest in sex, ability to achieve orgasm, changes in lubrication. A lot of women struggle with vaginal dryness and pain, and all of those things can start to make it such that they begin to avoid wanting intimacy. And once we avoid wanting intimacy with our partners, then that changes the whole dynamic of the relationship. So it's really important, especially in times of stress, that we try and, you know, maintain our intimate connections with those that we love, because once that falls apart, then everything else follows.
And I know you've talked a lot about this. There's data to show that if you neglect this part of your health, it can affect your health and your longevity overall, correct?
That's 100% correct. That people that, many studies have shown that people that are in relationships, regardless of sex, that are in long-term relationships, and it's the quality of those relationships that's important, and those are directly linked. Being in long-term relationships is directly linked to increased longevity, increased life satisfaction, job satisfaction, relationship satisfaction, but the point being the quality. And for whatever, you know, for better or for worse, men feel intimate and connected to us as women by virtue of us having sex with them. It just is what it is. And, you know, they have their, you know, they can be intimate, they can be vulnerable, all those things. But, you know, we need to be having, you know, sexual relationships. And that doesn't necessarily have to involve penile-vaginal intercourse. I'm not saying that's what defines sex, but being intimate in a sexual way. And if for whatever reason we withdraw as women from being sexually intimate due to stress, due to pain, due to loss of libido, then the men, just by virtue of that, don't feel emotionally connected to us. And then they start playing golf more, they're working more, they're this, they're that. They're still there, but it's not the same type of connection. And then when we're not feeling intimately connected with our partners, then we want to have sex with them even less, so it becomes a vicious circle. And that's why, you know, years ago, I think I saw it on Oprah, or somewhere they were talking about, someone was talking about just do it. Like, you have to just have sex. And I really, you know, was sort of offended by that. And I was like, what do you mean? That's awful. Like, what do you just have sex because you don't want to? But now I realize, now I'm in my 50s, and I, you know, I'm having, going through these changes myself. And I recognize that, you know, what they mean by that is that it's important to make it a priority. You don't want to all the time, but when you can shift and sort of focus and make the time and schedule the day, whatever it is, you know, put the kids away, put a lock on the door, that it is important. Otherwise, that's a part of us that gets neglected. And then, you know, health conditions can arise, relationship problems, yes, you know, which is a whole nother, a whole nother stressor when your relationship is in conflict.
Right. And this is just a preview of your talk, which I know will be a big hit. Thanks so much for giving us a few minutes. Lots of anticipation. Women really eager to meet you when you come to town. Dr. Jennifer Berman, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
And to hear some of Dr. Berman's cutting-edge treatments she wants to talk about for women and sexual health, well, you're just going to have to come to the event for that. So get your tickets now to Girls Day Out at wjct.org/events, the events this weekend at the Hyatt Regency. Back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, Tracking and Finding the Unabomber, a new scripted series on the Discovery Channel is based on the work of James R. Fitzgerald, an FBI profiler whose careful study of the language in the mail bomber's writing was critical to breaking the case. We'll speak with the real Fitzgerald about one of the biggest serial murder investigations in history. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'd managed to channel my rage into humorous commentary on the economy. BBC News wanted to know what I thought about the economic crisis. I was speaking for Ireland.
Join us for more True Stories Told Live. This week, it's a live show from Dublin, Ireland on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sit back, relax, and travel back in time with 89.9 on Sunday nights beginning at 7 with Radio Theater.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe.
Doo-wop Revival.
Good evening, I'm Glenn Fisher, the king of the doo-woppers.
Relax Radio. Throwback Sunday, Sunday nights beginning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT. Online at WJCT.org. Looking forward to looking back.
Well, finally this hour, it's a big donation supporting business education on the First Coast. First Florida Credit Union recently committed $250,000 to FSCJ to help both local students and community members get ahead in business. The funding provided by the credit union will launch the FSCJ Business Speaker Series and support the college's Financial Skills Academy. Here with more, Brent Lister, President, CEO of First Florida Credit Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Also with us, Annette Barano, Dean of Business at FSCJ.
Good morning.
And in a minute, Annette, I know you have a lot to say about what this means for the college. But first, Brent, what sparked this donation?
Well, as a credit union, we're a nonprofit cooperative, and we wanted to give back or find an avenue to help give back not only to the community, but also partners of ours, and our corporate office is right downtown, right across the street, and this was really our focus is enriching people every day, and and helping our members with financial solutions. And this just felt and looked like a great opportunity where FSCJ Works Program was trying to have an outreach program and increase their awareness and then provide efforts back to the businesses. So it just fit what we were looking for, and we're excited about the partnership and how we can help give back to the community.
And this is going to do a lot for FSCJ in terms of business education. What's going to be done with these funds, Annette?
Well, as you mentioned, we're starting a business speaker series. And with that series, we're going to have business leaders from our region, as well as the Southeast and nationally, come in and talk about issues of importance to our Northeast Florida region. And it will give our students, as well as community folks, a chance to come and hear trends and projections about what kind of skills are needed, what kind of jobs are going to be available, and it'll give them a chance to network with business leaders in the community. And these events are going to be free of charge thanks to First Florida.
To this generous donation.
Yes.
Five years of this series. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
That's a pretty lengthy series.
Yes, it is. We're going to have different speakers coming in, and we're going to be focusing on the industries that impact Jacksonville primarily.
Sure. And Brent, the other thing that will be done with this is FSCJ will have support for its Financial Skills Academy. That's so important because kids come into college basically with no financial skills. You know what I mean? They need help with that. I think most young adults do.
Oh, absolutely. And again, this collaboration and our focus as a credit union really focusing on financial wellness and education. And we have internal programs with our programs for middle schoolers, high schoolers, and we do a lot of outreach with that. The Financial Skills Academy really resonated with us because it's also giving back to the students, increasing the awareness, and it's a great program that not only the students but the employees of the college is eligible for to do, and they do some online and some in person, and the class curriculum fits the Skills Academy is about skills. It's not necessarily literacy. It's putting the skills in the students' hands to make good decisions for their financial lives. And I think you touched on it. Any financial education is well needed in from elementary through middle school, high school, and in college.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, my generation didn't get any of that, and we just learned it the hard way. Now, at least, I think academia is recognizing kids need this in a really structured way.
Absolutely, because so many families are not able to fully pay for college education, and they end up with debt. So these kind of classes help them become more aware of how to manage their finances and also prepare for the future and retirement as well.
Now, you're still lining up speakers for the speaker series,
yes,
correct?
We're still confirming this first year. We're still confirming, but as soon as we have our complete list, we'll do a press release and have the speakers and the dates and times. And again, these are free.
And open to the public.
Open to our faculty, our students, and the community at large.
It really shows how community and state colleges like FSCJ are filling such a vital role in communities. And in this kind of partnership, I think, exemplifies that.
Well, I think the awareness is more I learned about Florida State College of Jacksonville and what they're doing in the business community of helping helping businesses look for curriculum to train new employees. We're seeing the growth in Jacksonville from an economic standpoint, and Florida State College is working with small businesses and large businesses to make sure that they have trained employees. And that's one of the things that resonated with the Works program is, and especially the speaker series can maybe bring more awareness to it, mm-hmm. that being a local resource for training and certification, as well as degrees for the community, and working with businesses to set those up so they have a workforce in the future.
Keep your eye on FSCJ and the donation coming in from First Florida Credit Union as they launch their Business Speakers Series and Financial Skills Academy. Brent Lister, President and CEO of First Florida Credit Union. Annette Barano is Dean of Business at FSCJ. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Well, that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs our board during the show. And the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen to us there anytime or podcast it on iTunes. Next on 1A, it's been 16 years since the war in Afghanistan began. How will America's longest war end? I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.